Hello, I'm Bob McDonald. Welcome to Quirks and Quarks. Leading today's program, Rare Earth, questioning the existence of complex life elsewhere in the universe.
It's our examination of the fossil record and thinking about some astronomical things as well that lead us to believe that going from a microbe to a bunny or an animal of any sort, let alone intelligence, is exceedingly difficult, and we don't think that happens too often.
Also on the program, medicine on Mars, the dangers posed by a real mission to the red planet.
I think we probably also should expect some surprises as we send maybe 6 people off on a 30-month trip heading toward a planet that is largely unknown and unexplored and getting every second further and further away from not only their support structure back on Earth, but from everything they've ever known back on Earth.
Plus, the latest on a controversial breast cancer treatment, a look at the random factor in evolution, and the answer to whether centrifugal force is real or not. All this and more today on Quirks and Quarks. Are we alone on this tiny little orb on the outer spiral arm of a fairly run-of-the-mill galaxy in a very, very large universe? Are we the only example of the miracle of complex life? Well, we've been asking that question ever since we first understood that there was a universe. And as our understanding has expanded and the immensity of the cosmos has become more apparent, many have claimed that we can't possibly be alone. They say the universe is just too big for the accidents that created intelligent life here not to have happened millions of times elsewhere. But now two American scientists have challenged that conventional wisdom. In a new book called Rare Earth, paleontologist Peter Ward and astronomer Donald Brownlee suggest that the particular and peculiar set of circumstances that led to intelligent creatures like us may be extremely unlikely, possibly even unique. Of course, no one knows for sure, but the book has created some lively debate. Joining me now are two people with very different views on the subject. Dr. Peter Ward is one of the authors of Rare Earth and a paleontologist from the University of Washington in Seattle. And Dr. Seth Shostak is an astronomer from the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, or SETI, Institute in Mountain View, California, a group that's been looking for signals from other intelligent life in the universe. Gentlemen, welcome to the program.
Good to be here, Bob.
First of all, Dr. Shostak, I'd like to start with you by asking you just for some background here. Why is it that so many scientists have thought that life should be common in the universe?
Well, in some sense, Bob, this just goes back to Copernicus. I mean, for the last 450 years, astronomers have been telling us, look, we're not very special. We used to think we were the center of the universe, of course, and that idea was dispelled quite some time ago. But as we look farther into space, as our instruments are refined and so forth, we find that the sort of situation that we're in, on a cold planet around a rather ordinary star, is in itself, we think, somewhat ordinary. Planets are a dime a dozen in the universe. The miracle of life may not be a miracle. Maybe there's even life nearby, perhaps only simple life. But all these developments seem to point in the direction of telling us that biology may be very common in the universe, and maybe even smart biology.
Dr. Ward, can you give me a quick summary of your ideas before we get into some of the specifics? Why do you think it's rare?
Well, Seth and I really don't disagree on an awful lot of these issues. I believe, as Seth does, that life is out there, and life just pervades our galaxy and perhaps the universe. But I think our point of difference may be that Don Brownlee and I think that probably most of it's microbial, it's sludge life, but it's our examination of the fossil record and thinking about some astronomical things as well that lead us to believe that the next step, going from a microbe to a bunny or an animal of any sort, or even a worm or a planaria, let alone intelligence, is exceedingly difficult, and that you need, if life is a nice cake and a good cake is an animal, the oven has to be set at a very constant temperature for a long time, and we don't think that happens too often.
Why not?
Well, certainly on this planet it took, let's say we got life on this planet almost as soon as we theoretically could, about 3.8 billion years ago, and then we had to wait another 3 billion years to get animals. And either it takes a long time to build animals, which I don't believe, or it takes a long time to make an atmosphere conducive so that animals can live, which is probably what happened on this Earth. Our Sun is a very large star compared to the rest in this galaxy, only about 10% are larger than us, and most of the stars are probably too small. We don't think that there's going to be a constancy of conditions that allow liquid water to exist on a planet on most planets. And so we're really looking at a point of view where first you have to have an appropriate planet, and then you have to have a lot of really interesting but probably low probability things happen.
So from an astronomical point of view, if we just look at the number of stars in the galaxy, and how do you feel about the rareness of solar systems like ours and planets like the Earth?
Well, I suspect, and certainly Seth knows this, that the planet finding, showing that planets aren't rare, I mean, all of us want to believe that there are planets, and now we have actual evidence that there are. I suspect that virtually every star has planets going about it. But maybe it's not so much the importance of planets, but the stars themselves. And if there are planets, what types of planets are there? We are not going to exist on Jupiter or Uranus or Saturn. We need a rocky planet. And we need a rocky planet of pretty good size, because there are certain things about a planet that you also want. You want there to be a magnetic field, for instance. This appears to be very interesting in protecting us from ultraviolet. You want this phenomenon known as plate tectonics, which is a global thermostat. And if you want to have an intelligent civilization arise, you want metal deposits on your surface or near enough. Without plate tectonics, there's no ore bodies. You can't become a radio astronomer without metal.
Dr. Shostak, how do you respond to this idea that our solar system and something like that is rare in our galaxy?
Well, there's no doubt that our solar system may be a little bit special, but I don't think it's really all that special to begin with. Peter has said that, well, the Sun is a big star. It's bigger than 90% of all the stars in the galaxy, and in fact, that's true. Let's just throw out all those 90% of stars that are a little bit too small. That still leaves 10% of the stars in the galaxy, which are very much like our own Sun, and that means on the order of 40 or 50 billion just in this galaxy. Now, to me, that's a fairly large number. As far as what sort of planets you need, well, clearly, yes, you want liquid water. Now, I want to point out that water is a pretty common compound. There's water everywhere. Now, mind you, some of it is ice, maybe all of it is ice, but it's not clear that that's true. It seems that there's an ocean of water on Jupiter's moon Europa, more water than there is in the Atlantic and the Pacific put together. So I don't think that water is actually very uncommon either. These other sorts of factors. I mean, do we need plate tectonics? Well, I don't know. Maybe we do need plate tectonics. All that plate tectonics depends on is that you have a planet that has a little bit of heat on the inside from the radioactive decay of some of the elements that were used to make the thing in the first place. And I think that's going to be very common.
People at Caltech really don't think that's true, Seth, is that plate tectonics is going to be very difficult to get. Other aspects that really have led us to our conclusions are looking, and just going back to Seth's point, that if we have so many stars of Sun type, again, position in the galaxy is going to affect them as well. We think that closer to the center of the galaxy, there's going to be so many near-star passages. As we rotate around and around the galaxy on our cosmic merry-go-round, we're going to come close to other stars. The closer to the center we are, the more often that happens. When that happens, you perturb comets. When comets come rushing in, you create mass extinctions. Our planet has had 5 major mass extinctions in the last 500 million years, and some would argue that this is a good thing. If the dinosaurs aren't gone, we don't have this conversation. But let's say that we had 10 of those mass extinctions instead of 5, or let's say that we had 100, or let's say we had 10,000. I think very quickly we get to points where you cannot have the continued existence of animal life. If we are hit by a 20 to 30 kilometer body tomorrow, you can kiss animals on this planet goodbye. And this is the problem about being more centrally located in the galaxy. We think there's a fairly narrow sweep of real estate in any galaxy where you can have animal life.
Well, I just don't see that. Yes, we've had mass extinctions, and sure enough, 65 million years ago, the dinos and, 50% of all species were wiped out by a big rock from space. But I would complain that our planet has been deprived of these kinds of events. We need more asteroids because, as Peter just mentioned, had we had maybe 10 times as many asteroids as we do now, then the dinos wouldn't have sat around for 200 million years wasting our time. We'd have the cure for death now if it weren't for the fact that the dinos just sat on this planet for 200 million years, not really going anywhere. So I'd say a few more asteroids might be a good thing. All you want is that the interval between major impacts is not short compared to the amount of time it takes to develop intelligence when you can, of course, protect yourself against these things. And, you know, it's taken a million years to get humans going. These big asteroids hit every 100 million years, so you could use 100 times as many asteroids and not threaten the development of intelligent life.
Okay, I'd like to move from our cosmic address here and how much real estate there is in the galaxy to the uniqueness of the Earth itself. What other aspects of the Earth, Dr. Ward, do you think make it special that would not happen elsewhere?
Well, if we want intelligence, and we certainly do, it turns out that on Earth, if we have temperatures above about 45 degrees centigrade, our mitochondria stop. We are not animals that can live between 0 and 100 degrees centigrade. We have a very narrow temperature limit. Now, this is Earth-centric, but animal life, at least as we know it on this planet, is very temperature-dependent.
Dr. Shostak?
I'll agree with that. You need a range of temperature, but it isn't such an incredibly narrow range. This refers to what is called the habitable zone, the region from a star within which a planet could orbit where you have not only liquid water, but liquid water at the right temperatures. But I again point to Jupiter's moon Europa. Here's a situation where you would say, this is far out in the solar system. It's really cold out there. There couldn't possibly be life, let alone sophisticated life. Well, sometime in the next 10 or 20 years, we're going to send some ice fishermen to Jupiter's moon Europa, and they're going to drill down into the ice. They'll probably be robots, mind you, probably not people from Wisconsin. They'll drill down through that ice and drop a video camera or something else down in there, and it wouldn't surprise too many scientists if they found some sort of floating complex life in those waters. And that, of course, would, in some sense, end this argument.
I'd like to shift from thinking about complex life to intelligent and technological life. I mean, we have lots of intelligent life forms here on Earth, but they're not technological, like whales and dolphins. They have big brains, but they don't have machinery. What do you think are the odds of that, of other creatures on other planets developing technology that would be technology that could communicate with us, possibly?
Well, I've been very much struck by the necessity of metal deposits, and I know I've said this and it sounds really boring, but I'm a geologist, live with me. You have to have metal. You have to be a terrestrial creature. I don't think an underwater civilization could ever arise, but this might be a failure of my imagination, but we have to smelt metal, we have to work up to that, we have to get wires, we have to get electronics, and it's difficult to do any of that without metal. We have had a series of conditions on this planet that have allowed us to have access to the material that allows us to have radios or radio signals or the type of signaling that could certainly leak out of our atmosphere. Could an entirely submarine species do it? I don't think so.
But we've had those conditions on Earth for billions of years, and yet we've only had technology for, less than 1,000, or, not very long anyway, compared to the age of the Earth.
Well, we certainly took us a long time to get intelligence on this planet, and this is another interesting aspect of the debate. Is intelligence in a species inevitable? Is cephalization going to proceed inevitably towards large intelligence?
When you say cephalitis, you mean big brains there?
Big brains, exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
Sorry. The dinosaurs never really got very cephalized. They stayed around for 165 million years, and they had barely larger brains at the end than they did at the beginning. It's not necessarily an inevitable aspect of evolution that we get intelligence. Well, we get more intelligent. I mean, mammals are far more intelligent than worms, but could they build radio telescopes? And the answer is no. Steve Stanley and others have argued that there was a series of very improbable coincidences allowing the human subspecies or pre-species, pre-humans really, to evolve that very large brain, that you had once again some improbable events. Ernst Mayr, Steve Gould, a number of people think that it's totally unlikely that without those circumstances it would have happened.
This is a contentious point. Just because you have life on a planet and you let it sit there and do its thing for a few billion years, the question is indeed, how often will it cook up something that's intelligent enough to build a radio transmitter? And you know, the jury really is out on that. I think that there is a lot of debate about that. But let me say one more thing in that regard. Maybe we don't need a lot of intelligent species out there to make the search for cosmic company a fairly easy thing to do. If it's only happened even a few times in the galaxy, and if that biological intelligence takes the next step, the step that we may take in the next 20 or 30 years, and invents machine intelligence could spread out. And it may be that the galaxy is stuffed with intelligence, all developed by very few biologically intelligent species some time ago. In other words, machine intelligence.
So you're saying that our first contact may be with an alien machine rather than an alien?
I think that that's not such an unlikely scenario. I wouldn't be surprised if we pick up a signal from a transmitter and find that the guy behind the microphone is not a guy or a gal. It's, in fact, a machine.
Well, Dr. Shostak, let me bring you back to Dr. Ward's basic argument, though. He's saying there seem to be a lot of fairly lucky circumstances that led to our existence, and it seems plausible that those circumstances would be very uncommon. Now, what's your problem with this idea?
Well, this line of argumentation kind of reminds me of back when I was in school. My roommate was looking for a date, and he said, you know, he lamented, there are a million women in this city, and I can't seem to find a date. And I said, well, the trouble is that you're asking for something very special. I mean, you want them to be between 18 and 25. That knocks out 90% of them, so that means only, you know, 50,000 women. And then you want them to be single. That you know, brings it down to 20,000. And you want them to be good-looking, and that brings it down to 2,000. And you want a high IQ, and that brings it down to 200. And inside of a minute, it turned out that we could reckon that his requirements meant that there wasn't a single woman in this entire city that met those requirements. Nonetheless, the next weekend he had a date. I think that if we can look, very hard at our solar system, our planet, even our sun, and see very peculiar things about it. But I think what's I believe is incorrect is to say, because it's got its own personality, because our system has all these peculiar characteristics, it is somehow very finely tuned to, you know, complex life. I don't think that's the case. I'd like to hear from Peter what factor he thinks is a real showstopper. What characteristic does either our planet, our solar system, or our sun have that no other systems in the galaxy would have?
We're not looking at unique. What we're looking at is a series of elements, a series of factors that are low probability, each multiplied one by the other, that vastly reduces the possibility of intelligent life in the universe. We don't think that we're going to find a million civilizations, or even 100,000 civilizations, or perhaps even 10,000 civilizations, maybe not 1,000 civilizations. Maybe we have between 10 and 100 in our 100,000 light-year wide galaxy. We're lucky. And once they're spaced out, once we have so few, the possibility of talking to them is low. Do we stop SETI? No. Hell no. I think we have to look. Personally, I pay my money for SETI. I want us to look. But do I think we'll find anybody? I think no.
What's it going to take to answer this question one way or another?
Well, like
first, Mars. Let's go to Mars right now.
That's
first.
Yeah. Okay.
Seth, what else?
Well, obviously going to Mars. The thing is, I suspect that Peter may be right about Mars, that I suspect the Martians are going to be very small and very stupid, and namely they're going to be microbes. I have greater hopes for Europa. I think Europa has been an ocean sitting there for, as far as we can tell, 3.5 billion years, and it may have cooked up something as smart as a tuna. Who knows? I think that would be interesting. But, you know, in some sense, it's going to be impossible to prove that intelligence is rare or complex life is rare in the universe. I don't know how you'd prove that. But what you can prove, and what we hope to prove, is that that's not true. By finding another civilization or another intelligence, if you will, because who knows if it's a civilization, by finding that, then we have disproved the hypothesis that we are indeed the smartest things in the universe, something many people would like to believe, but I find difficult to swallow.
Dr. Ward, why does it matter if we're rare or not?
One aspect of the rareness deals, I think, with the number of species that are endangered on this planet. If we're correct that we are not alone, but certainly rare in terms of this animal life, then it raises the issues of extinction and our stewardship of this planet to kind of new levels. That makes us so much less disposable as a planet. It gives us a sense of our place in the cosmos.
Dr. Shostak and Dr. Ward, thank you both for speaking with us.
It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
Dr. Seth Shostak is an astronomer with the SETI Institute in California, and Dr. Peter Ward is a paleontologist at the University of Washington in Seattle. Rare Earth by Dr. Ward and David Brownlee is published by Copernicus Books. Coming up, false hope for breast cancer. Time to welcome back our regular medical columnist, Dr. Miriam Shuckman. Miriam is a freelance medical journalist in Toronto and teaches psychiatry and medical ethics at the State University of New York in Buffalo. Today she's here to talk about a new controversy surrounding a radical treatment for breast cancer. Welcome back to the program, Miriam.
Thanks, Bob.
Now, before we get to the controversy, let's talk about the treatment for breast cancer. What is it?
Well, the treatment was using very high doses of chemotherapy. So we have chemotherapy that's supposed to kill cancer cells, but doctors have always felt like they couldn't use the really high doses that would kill all the cancer cells because that would also kill off all your good cells, like the cells that form your blood. But they said, what if we take some of those cells out, we go into your bone marrow, take some of those blood-forming cells out, and then we bombard your body with this high-dose chemotherapy. We kill off all the cancer cells. We kill off your blood-forming cells, but then we'll transplant. We'll take these cells we took out of you before we hit you with the chemotherapy, and we'll transplant it back into you. Then you'll have your blood-forming cells, and you'll be fine, and we'll have killed off the cancer. That was the idea.
Oh, I see. So it's two things together. It's the transplant and the chemotherapy.
That's right. And this sort of thing, you know, the bone marrow transplant had been shown to work for leukemia and lymphoma and diseases of the blood system. So it looked like it was worth a try.
So, well, it sounds like a good idea. How widespread was it?
It was being used quite widely. In the U.S., probably 30,000 women had had this treatment over the course of the 1990s. I mean, a couple of promising reports in the late 1980s, women began to ask for it. Insurance companies were pushed to pay for it because it looked good, and this is a treatment for metastatic breast cancer, so disease that it's in its last stages for which there are very few treatments available. So women were, you know, really desperate and asking that this be covered. Insurance companies did cover it, so it came to be quite widespread south of the border.
Now, what about things like side effects?
This was a treatment that was fraught with risk and side effects. Because you're using such high doses of chemotherapy, the women were much more prone to infections and to actually very serious problems after the treatment. That was one of the known risks.
Okay, so there were risks and side effects, but there was great promise. What's the controversy?
The controversy is that it was being widely used before it had been shown to work. The only way you can really show whether something like this works or doesn't work is to do a head-to-head study. You take women who are getting this new controversial treatment, and you compare them directly with women who are getting the standard treatment, conventional chemotherapy. And you say, does this new treatment work any better? Is it worth the women taking the risk of this new treatment? And that's it's one of those studies, really the best of those studies, that's been released just this week in the New England Journal of Medicine. It hasn't even been published yet, Bob. They were releasing it early because they're saying these results are so dramatic and so important. We need to let you know, folks, the high-dose chemotherapy really is no better than conventional chemotherapy for people with metastatic breast cancer.
Wait a minute. You're saying that they're just releasing a study now saying that this new treatment, so-called new treatment, doesn't work? They didn't do that beforehand?
Yeah, and I am saying that, and that many thousands of women had this treatment despite the fact that it hadn't been proven to be effective. Now, in this country, all of the women who had this treatment, as far as I've been able to tell, all of the women were enrolled in clinical trials. That is, they were taking part in studies that were designed to show whether or not it was effective. So that Canadian women who had this treatment would have been told, look, we don't know yet whether it works, but we can enter you into a clinical trial designed to see whether this works better than the conventional therapy. But in the U.S., many women were saying, look, there's promising reports. We think this is going to work. You know, and doctors were saying, yes, we think it will work, and they were trying it even outside of the context of any study.
Well, how can that happen? How can you have such a painful treatment and, I guess, controversial one get accepted so widely?
I think it's a combination of factors. One is desperation. We don't have anything that works really well for this sort of, for this disease at that stage. The second was the concept seemed good. This was a treatment that had been shown to work for other serious disorders, and there was the theory sounded great, sounded like it should work.
I remember reporting on it here on Quirks. We did it as a new treatment for cancer a number of years ago.
Yeah, and the third thing was there were these studies that had been done. They weren't the best kind of study. They weren't the gold standard, the randomized clinical trial. But they were studies that looked, that showed that it looked like it would work. Now, we hear that those studies had some serious deficiencies. The women who were enrolled in those studies were likely to do better no matter what treatment they were put on. They were younger, they were healthier to begin with. So yes, they did better on this controversial treatment. They would have also done better on the conventional treatment. But when those studies came out, we didn't know there were any problems with them. They made the treatment look very promising, and it began to be widely accepted.
So it was a case of the desperation got ahead of the science. They didn't do enough science, but everybody just wanted it to happen so much. What did the insurance companies think of that?
Well, initially, the insurance companies wouldn't cover it. They said, you know, this is an experimental treatment. But women and physicians got, you know, up in arms and said, look, there's nothing else for us. And there's studies that show this can work. And early on in the U.S., this was a treatment that was costing $100,000 in some cases. The women could not pay for it themselves. So here you have women who are clearly going to die of their disease. They think this treatment will help them. And you either stand there and say, well, we don't care, we're not going to pay for it, or you capitulate, which is what many of these insurance companies did, and said, okay, look, you know, maybe it's worth a try. Now, of course, the insurance companies are, I think, going to be very grateful that there is sort of a definitive study saying this doesn't work, and Aetna has already said they won't pay for it anymore, and I think the other U.S. insurers will follow suit and stop paying for it.
So what happens now?
I think what happens now is that there's going to be a cry not only in the U.S. but around the world to say that anyone who's having this sort of controversial treatment ought to do it as part of a study. It's not that we shouldn't test out new ideas. Of course we should. But we shouldn't take them out of the laboratory and pretend that they're proven before they've been proven. If you want the controversial new treatment, enter into the clinical trial. Now, the risk you take is you'll get the conventional treatment because you'll be randomized. Some people will get the conventional treatment. Some people will get the new treatment. But the reason for that is no one knows yet if the new treatment works. So what all of the scientists I talk to are saying is that in order to be on this kind of treatment, you have to be in the setting of an ongoing study. It shouldn't be that doctors in a high-powered cancer center can just say, well, we think this is going to work, we'll do it, even though it hasn't been proved.
Providing false hope.
I think so.
Miriam, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Dr. Miriam Shuckman is a freelance medical journalist in Toronto and teaches psychiatry and medical ethics at the State University of New York in Buffalo. And we'd like to mention that the ongoing clinical trials to study this treatment will continue in the U.S. and Canada. I'm Bob McDonald, and you're listening to Quirks and Quarks, the national science program heard every Saturday on CBC Radio 1, on shortwave via Radio Canada International, and live on the Internet at cbc.ca. If you'd like to order a cassette copy of the program, or a Quirks t-shirt, lab coat, computer mouse pad, or a baseball cap, you can get all the information you need by calling our voicemail at 416-205-6131. That's 416-205-6131. Coming up, Red Planet Blues.
Now, what will begin as a rescue mission?
Let's go to Mars.
For Captain Jim McConnell and the crew of Mars 2 will lead to the greatest revelation in mankind's history.
That DNA looks human.
And change life on Earth as we know it. But Mars won't give up its secret without a fight.
You hit us, you can do it! Come on!
I'm not losing you!
This means that we're on the brink of the greatest discovery in mankind's history.
For centuries, we've searched for the origin of life on Earth. We've been looking on the wrong planet. Mission to Mars. Rated PG. Starts Friday, March 10th.
Well, that's the Hollywood version of what a space mission to Mars would be like, and yes, it's coming to a theater near you this weekend. But a real attempt to send humans to Mars would be very different, and just as dangerous. The danger, however, would come from an unlikely source, our own bodies. You see, the human body is not really designed to survive for long periods in zero gravity. And that's created some serious problems for the people who are planning the real mission to Mars. Dr. John Charles is a physiologist and senior mission scientist at NASA's Johnson Space Center in Houston. He's the man responsible for developing the medical research and technology necessary for travel to Mars and beyond. Welcome to Quirks, Dr. Charles.
Glad to be here.
Let's start with the problems of life without gravity. What happens to the human body, like, right from the moment when you first want to travel in space and you get into a rocket?
Well, assuming you survive the several hours on the launch pad without any discomfort and the brief but dramatic launch phase building up to perhaps 3 Gs during the acceleration to orbital velocity, once you reach once you reach low Earth orbit and you're weightless, your body immediately begins going through a whole sequence of changes. Some body systems adapt more quickly and others take much, much longer to adapt.
Can you take me through some of those changes?
One of the first things that changes is your organs of balance respond to the absence of gravity. The vestibular system, the organs that tell your head which way gravity is pulling the body, for the first time perhaps in your life, they don't feel gravity anymore, and they have to begin responding to an environment where their fundamental signal is no longer present. They have to learn how to adapt to that signal being absent. That process is probably the root cause of the space motion sickness, also called space adaptation syndrome, that afflicts perhaps 75% of the astronauts for the first minutes or hours or even the first few days of spaceflight. After several days, the vestibular system is well on its way to being comfortable in its new altered environment, but the cardiovascular system, which responds almost as quickly, is still going through its changes. The body fluid is redistributed through from the lower part of the body to the upper part of the body, causing what astronauts call bird legs and puffy faces to occur. That's one of the first stimuli to changes in the cardiovascular system. Those changes in the cardiovascular system may take days to weeks to resolve fully. There is evidence from some of these space station missions of the U.S. Back during the 1970s that the cardiovascular response to certain kinds of stress may not level off for the first 3 or 4 weeks in spaceflight.
Boy, sounds pretty dramatic. You got first thing that happens, you go into space, is you throw up. Then after you get over that, your body changes its shape, and you get a fat face, and then your cardiovascular system is all messed up. It sounds like pretty traumatic change that happens to you just during your first week.
Well, there's more, though. The longer you stay in space, the more your muscles change, because your muscles respond largely to the need to heft your body around here on Earth's surface against the 1G, one gravity, Earth's normal gravity. When you're weightless, the muscles don't have to exercise as much, and they do what normal muscles do when you don't exercise them, that is, they start to atrophy, to get smaller and less functional, more weak. And your bones follow suit over the first several months in spaceflight, at least. You may lose up to 1% of your bone density, your bone mass, for every month you stay in weightlessness. Presumably that will level off at some point. Presumably if you stay in space for 100 months, you won't lose all of your bones, but nobody's documented that yet. I think the smart way to bet is that we're going to level off at some functional bone state, but it has yet to be documented. These all sound like bad things, but in fact, I think the thing that has impressed me the most about the research that I've come across in spaceflight medical experience is how adaptable the human body is. You go through these changes early on, and some of the changes may take a long time to fully express themselves, but they're changes. They're not decrements per se. The body is simply adapting itself to a new way of living in a brand new environment, and then after hours or days or even weeks, the body seems to be fairly well adapted to the new environment and is perfectly comfortable staying in that new environment.
So what happens if we take all of those changes and extend it out now to the time that it would take to go to Mars and back again?
A trip to Mars, according to current thinking, is probably going to take about 6 months, maybe as little as 4 months or 5 months, depending on the particular launch opportunity, which year you go. But the six-month trip out is not all that different from the experience that the Russians and the Americans have had on various space stations, most recently the Mir space station. The interesting part's going to be the 18 months, that's a year and a half, that it's going to be required to stay on the surface of Mars waiting for the planets to realign so that you can make your six-month trip back to Earth. We're talking in the current plans with about a 30-month trip, a round trip from Earth to Mars, staying on Mars and returning back to the Earth. The 6 months in weightlessness is actually territory that's fairly well explored. the 18 months at Mars' lower surface gravity of about one-third of a G, one-third of Earth's normal surface gravity, is largely unexplored, both in terms of duration and in terms of the effectiveness or lack of effectiveness of that G level in protecting the changes or preventing the changes that may occur with continued exposure to the factors of spaceflight.
Beyond all of the physical things that can happen to the human body when it's trying to adapt to space, what about the psychological effect of putting five or six people inside a tin can for more than a year and having them get along with each other?
The psychological aspects of long-duration space explorations that we're talking about here, I think, are the most significant of the mission. I think the more interesting and the more challenging aspect is going to be, how do you keep a group of, say, six people not just sane, not just intact intellectually, but motivated, functional, and anxious to continue the mission. That's one of the big lessons that the American side got from the Russian space station Mir when we put our American astronauts on the Mir station, is we learned viscerally what we'd always known intellectually, and that was the importance of psychological support and making sure that we thought of all the things that people like you and me need to keep ourselves happy on Earth's surface. A lot of attention is being paid to that. I think we're much better prepared now with the Mir experience behind us than we would have been without it. But I think we probably also should expect some surprises as we send maybe six people off on a 30-month trip in an environment, in a vehicle that's probably not much bigger than a Winnebago, knowing all the time that they're getting further and further from Earth. And by further and further, I mean perhaps up to 20 minutes by radio from Earth, knowing that they're isolated like no people have ever been isolated before, in the sense that just outside the walls is a deadly vacuum and seething with radiation, heading toward a planet that is largely unknown and unexplored, and getting with every second further and further away from not only their support structure back on Earth, but from everything they've ever known back on Earth.
If we have a mission to Mars that's going to be many, many months long, and especially if people are jumping around on another planet, accidents are bound to happen. Now, what happens if somebody breaks a leg or their appendix bursts or they need some surgery? How serious is that going to be?
The possibilities for a traumatic incident on a space flight, and especially on a planet like Mars, which is going to be unprepared. It's going to be a rough surface, and you're going to be expected to do a lot of vigorous activity on that surface. The possibility of trauma is quite large, and it's being planned for. It's being considered. There are different approaches to that. The intent is to minimize the direct surgical intervention as much as possible, because you're not going to have an ER, you're not going to have an emergency room or an operating theater and a staff of trained physicians waiting for you to come in with your burst appendix or your broken leg. The idea is to try and protect the crew members as much as you can procedurally to make sure they don't break a leg if at all possible. But also, part of the planning for trips to Mars and elsewhere in the solar system is to understand that you cannot have exploration without risk, and there may be some levels of risk that you just cannot physically accommodate. You can't build a big enough rocket ship to carry a big enough treatment center to take care of all the possible traumas you're likely to come across. So part of the planning for exploration missions like we're discussing here is for all of us as a society to understand that not everybody that goes on these trips is guaranteed a return ticket, and there may well be cases where you just have to sort of let somebody go the way of that they're going to go. And that's the decision, I think, that has to go beyond NASA. NASA is a can-do agency, but we need to have the government and society as a whole decide if it's something we should do. I think NASA has the responsibility of defining the risk and protecting the risk and minimizing the risk, but then we as a society have to decide if the remaining risk is worth the benefit from the expedition.
Dr. Childs, thank you very much.
My pleasure, sir.
Dr. John Childs is a physiologist and senior mission scientist at NASA's Johnson Space Center in Houston. Coming up, the fickle stickle. What if we could just start all over again? Take yourself back in time 10 years. Would you make the same decisions, the same choices, given the same circumstances? If you had a second chance, would everything still work out the same way? Well, that's actually a question biologists often ask about evolution.
Is evolution programmed to work in particular ways so the evolutionary destiny of a species is predetermined? Or is it a more random process so that the evolutionary outcome is basically unpredictable? Different theories of how evolution works support both ideas, and there's been a lot of scientific debate over which idea is more likely correct. But unfortunately, experiments to test these theories are difficult to do. To actually watch evolution in action requires so much time it can't be done in a lab. But recently, Howard Rundel and his colleagues at the University of British Columbia found a natural experiment that provides some insight into this puzzle. Mr. Rundel is a doctoral candidate in the Department of Zoology at UBC. Mr. Rundel, welcome to Quirks and Quarks.
Thank you, Bob.
Now, first of all, how big a question is this whole thing in biology?
It's a fairly big issue. Our work concerns the mechanisms by which new species arise. That's a process we call speciation. And it is still very much an unknown in evolutionary circles.
Why is that?
Ever since Darwin's On the Origin of Species, some 140 years ago, biologists have been very interested in the mechanisms by which new species arise. In fact, Darwin dealt with this very little in the book. Since that time, a lot of work has been going on in trying to understand the mechanisms which may create the diversity we see in the world today.
So what was the natural experiment that you were involved in to help to answer this question?
Yeah, nature has presented a natural experiment, as you say, in the form of these two species of sticklebacks, which is a freshwater fish. They occur in a number of lakes along the coast of British Columbia, and in fact, their evolution demonstrates this repeated pattern that we have taken advantage of.
What pattern is that?
Well, that's that in at least three separate lakes, we see two forms of these sticklebacks. That is, there's an open water form that lives out in the middle of the lake and feeds on plankton. It's a smaller, more slender, kind of missile-shaped fish. In the same lake, there's also another form. This form lives along the shoreline or along the bottom of the lake, and it's a larger, more deeper-bodied fish, and it feeds on insects. And these two forms, the open water and the shoreline form, occur in these three separate lakes. And the same form, for instance, the open water form, looks remarkably similar in each lake.
Okay, so you've got these fish that look the same in three lakes. What's the significance of that? Why were you interested in it?
It becomes really interesting when we put it in context of work that's been done by some other colleagues at the University of British Columbia. That's Eric Taylor. And what he's shown through the use of genetic techniques is that these two forms in each of these lakes are actually independently evolved. And what I mean by that is that this open water form that you see in one lake has evolved independently of the open water forms in other lakes. In other words, we didn't evolve this form once and then colonize the different lakes to give us the open water form in three different lakes, but it actually evolved from the same ancestor independently in these lakes. And the same is true of this shoreline form.
So you're saying that evolution happened three times in three different locations in the same way?
Correct. So that becomes the first interesting observation, is that we end up with the same product here. That is, we end up with an open water form and a shoreline form, and they look remarkably similar. And that's a pattern that evolutionary biologists refer to as parallel evolution.
Hmm. So what originally happened here? Did you start out with one kind of fish that evolved into these two species? What went on?
These are all derived or evolved from a marine ancestor that's a stickleback that lives in the marine environment in the ocean. And this marine environment has colonized these freshwater lakes since the retreat of the glaciers about 10 to 12,000 years ago.
Now, they may look similar, but, I mean, especially to somebody like me, a lot of fish look alike. I mean, are they really similar, or could there be differences that perhaps you haven't seen?
It depends on what level you're looking. On what they look like level, they're very hard to tell apart. What we call morphologically. They look quite similar, and you have a hard time if you handed even someone like me who's spent a lot of years looking at these things two open water forms in different lakes, I'd have a hard time telling you which one came from which lake. Where our study comes in is asking how similar are they at another level, and that's at the mate choice level.
In other words, do the fish find each other that different?
Exactly, that's correct. So what we did was we tested how likely they were to mate with other individuals taken from these different lakes. And what we found was that the open water form from one lake was just as likely to mate with an open water form from a different lake as with one from its own lake. The same was true of the shoreline form. A shoreline form from one lake was just as likely to mate with a shoreline form from a different lake than one from its own lake. So in other words, they couldn't tell each other apart. Now, the open water and the shoreline form wouldn't mate with each other, no matter what combination of lakes you put together.
Oh, I see. So what does this all tell you, then, about the way evolution has worked for these fish?
Well, I guess what we're saying here is that the same species, this open water form, has actually evolved multiple times. Such a deterministic outcome
of evolution to produce the same species multiple times would surprise a lot of people, including a lot of people doing research in evolution. The fact that natural selection can be so predictable as to give us the same species when put into the same environment multiple times. I think a lot of people would have thought that some unique difference among the lakes or some chance historical occurrence would have given you different forms in each lake, even though the environments are similar.
How long did this whole process take to happen?
It took approximately 10 to 12,000 years, and we know that because approximately 12,000 years ago, all these lakes were covered by the last glacial ice age.
So if you're saying that, at least in this case, in the case of these lakes and these stickleback fish, that the evolution seems to be fairly predictable at this point, can it be predicted in the future?
That's a very interesting question, Bob. And the pattern of parallel evolution, that is getting the same trait evolving multiple times, is becoming more common in the evolutionary literature. The fact that we've now pushed that a step farther in saying that we're actually getting the same species evolving multiple times will surprise a lot of people. How far back we can push this predictability is still an open question.
Well, how does this add to the question about how random evolution is?
Well, there's a fairly vigorous debate that's been going on in evolutionary circles concerning how predictable is an evolution. To deal with the creation of new species, the debate is focused on what are the relative roles of natural selection, thus predictable evolution, and genetic drift, in other words, non-predictable evolution. And our work is some of the first evidence that comes from nature that suggests that indeed natural selection is producing new species, and thus the process is occurring in a somewhat predictable manner. We're getting the same species evolving in the same environment multiple times.
What's the next step for you?
Well, for me, the next step is finishing my doctoral thesis, which continues some of this work, and asking the questions of the relative roles of drift and natural selection, both using laboratory organisms like the fruit fly to try to test the relative roles of these forces, and hopefully to try to move some of this to continue the work in nature to try to see whether or not we can determine the actual way in which different species evolved.
Mr. Rundle, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Howard Rundle is a doctoral candidate in the Department of Zoology at the University of British Columbia. His paper on stickleback evolution was published in the journal Science. And now it's time for the Quirks and Quarks question of the week. Yes, this is your chance to get the answers to those nagging science questions that have been bothering you all these years. This week we have a somewhat circular query.
Hi, this is Brent Campbell from Brandon, Manitoba, and my question deals with centrifugal force. I've heard that centrifugal force doesn't really exist, that it's an imaginary force we talk about to explain the reaction we feel to the real force involved, centripetal force. Could you elaborate on this?
Well, for the answer, we go to the University of Manitoba and Dr. Jasper McKee, Emeritus Professor of Physics. So, Dr. McKee, is centrifugal force real or not?
I believe not. Fictional forces are not really forces at all, but they arise from the inertia of an object. But the idea can sometimes be useful in trying to interpret the behavior of objects in what are called non-inertial or rotating systems, which aren't adequately covered by Newton's laws of motion.
Okay, so if I've got a rock on a string and I'm spinning it around over my head, it
yep.
certainly feels like something is pulling outwards, that thing they call centrifugal force. I can feel it pulling on my hand. Now, if you're saying it's not really there, what is there? What's going on?
Well, there's a centripetal force which is making the rock move in the circle. In the absence of the string, it would want to be going in a straight line, according to Newton's first law of motion. So you're actually constraining it from doing that. If subjectively, you will have the impression of an outward pull, but in reality, it's moving in a circle because of the centripetal force that is generated through the string. Let me show you what the significance of that is, because centrifugal means acting outwards or flying away, and centripetal is towards the center. Now, if in fact the rock is wanting to fly away, if I cut the string at some point, the rock would be expected to move radially outwards and disappear, which of course it doesn't do. Anybody with any experience will know that. If you cut the string, it moves tangentially to the circle at which it's moving at the time, and so it goes off sideways rather than radially. And that's what you expect if, in fact, you just turn off the one important force, which is the centripetal force. So you cut the string, the centripetal force disappears, and it then starts to behave as if it was operating according to Newton's first law, which means it continues in uniform motion in a straight line until something happens to it.
Oh, I see. So there isn't actually a force pulling outward. It's just the rock wanting to go in a straight line, and the only force that exists is me pulling it inwards. That's the centripetal force.
That's it.
Why then do we have this thing called centrifugal force if it doesn't actually exist?
Well, there are various instances in which people find it convenient if they're in a rotating system, which is what this is. They feel the reality of what appears to be an outward pushing force rather than the centripetal one that's actually the important one. If you take yourself as a passenger in a car that's going to turn around a tight left-hand turn, as it turns to the left, with the centripetal force is generated by the tires interacting through friction with the road, and so it turns to the left. But you have an And you are moving in a straight line and hoping to continue to move in a straight line despite the fact that the car is moving to the left. And so you find yourself pressing against the right-hand passenger seat as this occurs, and you think, gracious, there is a force that's trying to pull me outwards, whereas the reality is, if I look at it from outside, I say, this is a very simple system. A centripetal force is acting and the car is turning to the left. So there's perception and reality. And in some cases, you can express the perception in a sort of quantitative form through this centrifugal force, but it's really not the fundamental force. It's not the agent of change. The physics is all in the centripetal force.
Okay, so for Brent Campbell, there you are. Centrifugal force is fictional. It's actually objects trying to move in straight lines, and it's only the centripetal force pulling inward that is the force in action. Dr. McKee, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob, very much.
Dr. Jasper McKee is Emeritus Professor of Physics at the University of Manitoba, and he's got many more answers to those kinds of questions in his new book, Physics in the Real World, which is published by Minerva Press. And we welcome all your questions, no matter how forceful, so keep those cards, letters, and emails coming in. We'll give you the addresses in just a minute. And that's it for this week's edition of Quirks and Quarks. Next week, Portrait of a Canadian Scientist, Irene Uchida. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can write to us at P.O. Box 500, Station A, Toronto, M5W1E6. Our email is quirks@toronto.cbc.ca. And the number to call if you want information on purchasing any Quirks merchandise or ordering a cassette copy of the program is 416-205-6131. And to get to our webpage, just go to cbc.ca and follow the links. Quirks and Quarks is produced by Jim Hanman, Jim Levins, Amy Folks, and Tim Lorimer. I'm Bob McDonald. Thanks for listening.
You are listening to CBC Radio 1, News and More. Definitely Not the Opera is about to begin just after this next newscast. The Junos are coming up Sunday, and the gang at DNTO pick the best from the past year in Canadian music. It was a very good year, wasn't it? Yes, it was a very good year. More, too, on DNTO. Global Village tonight has a report on an organization that protects musicians who offend the powers that be in their countries. Music can be subversive. Hear Global Village tonight at 7:05, 6:05 Atlantic, 6:35 Newfoundland.